New Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers was sworn in Monday before a packed crowd at the state capitol.
The people of Wisconsin demanded a change this November, and that change is coming.
Evers is the former head of the State Department of Public Instruction. He replaces Republican Scott Walker, who served 2 4-year terms. Walker and 4 of Evers' other predecessors were in attendance for the inauguration. The office of governor has been held by 45 people before Evers. We asked former state historian Michael Stevens to share his thoughts on which governors have had the greatest impact on Wisconsin.
Often people refer to the La Follettes as one of the best known names, or they refer to somebody in the recent past. But I think that many people would be surprised that I would consider Francis McGovern, who was governor between 1911 and 1915, Wisconsin's most effective and significant governor. He was a Republican. He came from Milwaukee. And he outlined an agenda that sounds remarkably modern in his State of the State address in 1911. He was advocating for campaign finance reform, increased teacher pay, roads improvement, natural resource protection, tax fairness, increase to the UW budget, vocational education, and so on. We don't remember him that much because he wasn't flashy like the La Follettes. He was kind of an inside, nuts and bolts, good government guy.
Now, those are a lot of the issues that are still being talked about these days, but not necessarily by the Republicans.
Right. I think it reflects that he had his finger on the pulse of the future and the key kind of things. It is striking that 100 years later, the kinds of things Francis McGovern called for, we're still debating. One of the things that makes McGovern stand out is most of the items that he called for in 1911 were enacted into law. The key legislation, there was a Corrupt Practices Act, today's vocational education school, that entire system was created under him. The first county ag agents were started. What we now know as workers' compensation was passed. There was factory and safety laws. The predecessors of the DNR were created, a forest commission, the predecessor of Department of Transportation, Highway Commission, state life insurance funds, farm cooperatives, all kinds of things that were enacted. And there were even some other ideas that he proposed that didn't become law during his term, but were enacted later. Things like recall elections or the line item veto. He would say that political freedom and social justice go hand in hand.
That's quite a list of accomplishments. How did that compare to the people who came prior to him or the people who followed? What were they interested in, and how wide-reaching were their goals?
Well, in the 19th century, Wisconsin government was very small. Fewer people living in the state. We didn't have the kind of extensive manufacturing or need for regulation. In some ways, Bob La Follette and the Progressives started those efforts with things like the direct primary, which was a brand new idea in the early 20th century, and the idea of railroad regulation, bans on allowing railroads to give free passes to elected officials, legislators. So it is part of a consistent theme. Nearly all of these ideas, of course, originated in the Republican Party at that time. Which was a party that dominated state politics. The Democrats of that era were a small government, low tax, anti-regulation party.
In more modern history, it's tempting to say that Governor Walker was a really significant governor because of Act 10 and also because of a lot of the other measures that he and fellow Republicans pushed through in his first year or two in office, including redistricting and voter ID, and also to say that Tommy Thompson was so significant because of his welfare overhaul, school choice, and the fact that he served for so long. But are there some other people who you think are worth mentioning, too?
You know, I think Patrick Lucy comes very close to being maybe second on my list. And interestingly enough, when he was governor between 1971 and 77, he hung Frances McGovern's picture in his office. Pat Lucy, a Democrat, hung the picture of Republican Frances McGovern. And I think what is remarkable about Patrick Lucy is he was a very low-key kind of guy, much like McGovern. In fact, he used to make fun of himself. He said, "I don't think I'd recognize charisma if it hit me in the head. And I've only learned how to pronounce the word in recent years." But he was effective at working across the aisle. When he was elected, he had a Republican Senate that he had to work with, but he was effective. His big change was creating UW merger, which was a major change. Prior to Pat Lucy, we had two systems. There was the University of Wisconsin system, which was Madison and a couple of other campuses, including Milwaukee. And then there was the Wisconsin State University system, which included places like Platteville, Whitewater, Eau Claire, La Crosse. And you had basically two boards of regents, two heads of the system. And what Pat Lucy was trying to do was rationalize the whole UW system, allowing people to transfer back and forth, that there would be some kind of consistency, and eliminate the kind of annual competition between the campuses and the different systems to make it easier for the state to rationally allocate money and view it as a statewide educational system rather than having to deal with separate appropriations bill. It was very controversial at the time and required a lot of consultation, and some people at the time liked it, some didn't, but it probably is his single biggest accomplishment. And at that time, when it was enacted into law, it created the UW system that we know today, which was the largest state university system in the country. And then there were a lot of other things, which sounds a lot like nuts and bolts, but really made a difference to people's pocketbooks. So equalization of aid for school districts, tax distribution to local government, tax reform, very much a good government kind of guy. He was also the first governor to extensively use the line item veto, which had been around since 1930, but Pat Lucy was a kind of an expert at that. First one to use the veto to strike out a single digit, so changing an appropriation for something like $150 million, and he strikes out the zero, and suddenly it's $15 million. So very much a pragmatic governor who could work across the aisle. And later in his career, he left the Democratic Party to run for vice president on John Anderson's unity ticket in 1980. But I think he was very, very similar. You know, there are some similarities even with people like Tommy Thompson in their ability to be an effective governor when they had an opposition, a party in opposition in the legislature. So Pat Lucy was very effective.
There's been a lot of talk in the last few weeks about the role and the powers of the governor with the measures that the Republican-dominated legislature approved recently to strip the incoming governor of some of his powers. Other than that particular event in the very recent past, have there been times over the state's history where the role or duties or power of the governor changed in any significant fashion?
Oh, absolutely. In much of the 19th century, the governor played a much less prominent role in state governance. Of course, the legislature played a much less prominent role because they met infrequently. There was less government to manage. But in the 20th century, there were three really significant changes in the powers of the government. One was the development of the executive budget. Prior to 1911, each state agency submitted its own budget, and there was a separate budget bill, which made it really hard to manage the state's finances as a whole. There was various experiments in trying to create a consolidated state budget. 1931, the governor received the authority to create the initial executive budget. As we all know today, The legislature doesn't always adopt the budget as prepared by the governor, but it makes the governor involved in the process from the very beginning rather than just at the end at the veto stage. That was a major change in that it allowed the governor to lay out a consistent plan for the entire state. Governor Phil La Follette, son of Fighting Bob, was the first to have that, but that was advocated throughout the 1920s and even beyond that. And so it changes the dynamics of what a governor can do by being able to propose programs, especially programs that cross over different agencies where you might want to do something consistent. And that was really, really significant. The second big change was introduction of the line item veto. Wisconsin has one of the strongest governor's vetoes in the nation. And this was another idea Francis McGovern proposed. It didn't get created till 1930. And the argument here was when a budget gets passed, the governor formerly had a choice of either vetoing the whole thing or signing the whole thing. And the argument was that special interests might be able to get something into the budget that, in the governor's view, might not be good public policy. The governor could line item out language and dollars in appropriations bill. There's still a possibility of a legislative override, but that line item veto really changed the dynamics of that. And historically, very few line item vetoes have ever been overridden. Governor Phil La Follette was the first governor to use the line item veto. Most governors use maybe 4, 5, 10 vetoes during their entire term. Pat Lucey was one of the first to use a single digit veto and used it much more extensively than other governors. Tommy Thompson, I think, probably still holds the record for the most number of line item vetoes. There was one budget bill where he set the record 457 line item vetoes in a single bill. It, again, changed the dynamics, the relationship between the governor and the legislature. The veto in Wisconsin is a very, very important tool. Earlier, I mentioned there were three specific changes, and I think there's one other one that maybe your listeners would be interested in.
Sure.
We again assume it's normal to have a cabinet form of government with a secretary of the DNR or a secretary of agriculture. Prior to the 1960s, Wisconsin did not have a cabinet form of government. And the Kellogg Commission, which was another good government effort to reorganize Wisconsin government so it better serve the 20th century, reorganized all the state agencies, consolidated them, because there were these little fiefdoms and commissions with commissioners who were running state agencies. And the governor was given appointment powers of cabinet secretaries, a new idea in the 1960s. And while he could have appointed commissioners, it takes a while to there's a majority of commissioners in any particular agencies. This cabinet form of government probably is the most important change that has happened in the last 50 years in Wisconsin government. We take it for granted, but it has changed the powers of the governor. And I think it's kind of striking. If you look at the first 100 years of Wisconsin or 125 years of Wisconsin history, the typical governor served between 2 and 4 years. Since 1971, our governors have averaged 6 years. And we've had very few one-term governors. And governors served until 1971 only two-year terms. It takes 2 years to really learn what you're doing. With the introduction of a four-year governor's term in 1971, along with a cabinet form of government, really has changed the story and the role of the governor. The governor becomes the key figure who is in office long enough to make change, and his appointment authority has been really, really important in carrying out the governor's plans.
As I mentioned earlier, it's easy to get caught up in the recent past, especially those of us who follow sort of the inside baseball aspects of it. And I'm wondering how things feel for you as a historian at this point in time when we are about to say goodbye to one governor and say hello to another one. Do you think about this in terms of how Governor Walker will go down in history or the potential for what Governor Evers might accomplish? Or do you sort of step back and wait a few years and see how the dust settles before you begin to form those opinions as a historian?
Well, there's the old saying that Chinese Premier Zhou Enlai was asked what he thought of the French Revolution. He said it's too early to say. As a historian, really hard to look at what's going on in the last 20, 30 years, because we don't know how the story turns out. There's almost these inadvertent twists and turns. And, many people are very surprised, for instance, that in 1910, the Republican Party was the party of big spending, government regulation. The Democratic Party was the party of low taxes, small government. If you asked a historian in 1910 about that, they probably would say it's too close because things do flip and change.
That's former state historian Michael Stevens.